This study on biblical covenantalism is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. Dr. Paul Hennebury, president of Telos Biblical Institute, will be our teacher. It's our prayer that this presentation will deepen your understanding of the Bible and allow you to draw closer in your relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now let's hear from Dr. Hennebury as he continues his presentation on this important topic.
Up until now, what we've been doing is looking at the biblical covenants and particularly the new covenant. And we've been seeing that the Old Testament prophetic witness to these covenants is a major part of their output and their calling, and is also consistent from prophet to prophet, from time to time. Extra details are given with the progress of time, and that the biblical covenants all are complementary. They run together, especially under the auspices of the new covenant and the renewal that comes in the new covenant. Renewal via salvation and sanctification of God's people, and the renewal and restoration of the land, and the setting up of the messianic kingdom. In the last lecture, we looked at Ezekiel's temple, and we saw that, again, once we understand that this temple is a literal structure that is very clearly given prominence in the Old Testament, and that this also takes into account the other biblical covenants as consummated through the new covenant, then we have a very comprehensive view of the covenantal program of God in the Old Testament. That's what I've been trying to give you up until this time. The biblical covenants, remember, are God's signposts to the way that He works in the world, to His plan and purpose, His decree, and everything else must dovetail with what these covenants say. Covenants are only useful if they mean what they say, and if the person making the oath of the covenant intends to fulfill that oath. God is the covenant-making God. God always means what He says. He's the one who has designed language. He can use language to express what He means. His yea is always yea. His nay is always nay. He does not prevaricate, and covenants are no place to start employing symbolic or allegorical interpretations. They have to mean what they say, and they do. This means that everything else that we have read so far in the Old Testament must complement the wording of the biblical covenants. And so, having said that, we now turn to another important prophetic book, the book of Daniel. Daniel is written during the time of the Babylonian exile, of course. And Daniel is important because it gives information which is going to be useful once we get into the New Testament. Daniel is not alone in giving important information that we can identify and pick up upon and use when we study the New Testament, but Daniel does have a very important role to play. Now, if you'll turn to Daniel chapter 2, we're going to start there. Daniel 2, of course, deals with Nebuchadnezzar's vision. Now, the vision is revealed by Daniel in verse 31 and following of chapter 2. But before looking at that, there is a very important historical marker that we need to pay attention to in verse 28. In that verse, we're told, "But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days." The latter days. Now, this term is extremely important. It's first used in Numbers 24 and verse 14. That is, in Balaam's oracle. This is one of the great Pentateuchal poems that we looked at in the first course. Now, verse 14 says, "And now, indeed, I am going to my people. Come, I will advise you what this people will do to your people in the latter days." And then you have a very clear prediction of the coming kingdom. Notice in verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. You see that? Obviously, that dovetails with Genesis 49 and verse 10. So that's talking about Christ. It's a messianic prophecy. So that's what it's talking about when it talks about the latter days, the messianic kingdom. Another important text is in Jeremiah chapter 23, which includes an important messianic prediction in verses 6 and 7 of that chapter. But if you'll look to verse 20, it says, the anger of the Lord will not turn back until he has executed and performed the thoughts of his heart. In the latter days, you will understand it perfectly. Now, that use of the latter days, some people might think that that's got to do with the destruction under Nebuchadnezzar, or perhaps the destruction under the Roman armies. But I don't think so. I think this has got more to do with the prediction of Numbers 24, and also especially that which is spoken of by Moses in Deuteronomy 4, verse 30. And we looked at Deuteronomy chapter 4 and saw that that was a prediction of the end time. Now, a similar text to the one in Jeremiah 23 is in Jeremiah 30, at the end there. Verse 24, the fierce anger of the Lord will not return until he has done it, and until he has performed the intents of his heart. In the latter days you will consider it. Now, of course, Jeremiah 30 is an important prophetic passage, and it links in with chapter 31 through 33. Remember, Jeremiah 30 has that prediction of Jacob's trouble in verse 7, but also a prediction of restoration in verses 8 and 9. And that dovetails with another use in Deuteronomy chapter 31 and verse 29, which reminds us of Deuteronomy 4:30, again speaking of the end times. So all of these are eschatological references. They reference the last days or the end times. Another clear end times reference is Hosea chapter 3 and verse 5. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. So you see the combination of New Covenant and Davidic Covenant there. They shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. This is all, by the way, the same Hebrew word for latter days. So we're not just expounding from the English here. This is what the Hebrew text says. Now, returning to Daniel chapter 2, we see therefore in verse 28 that this dream and its fulfillment has to do with the latter days, the end times. Let's have a look at it. Verse 31. You, O king, were watching and behold a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. And then the images describe a head of fine bronze, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Then verse 34, you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Okay, now there's the vision. Now Daniel's going to give us the interpretation. Clearly, the key elements that we want answers to are, what do the different parts of the image, the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, and the iron and clay, what do they all mean? What do they represent? And then, of course, most importantly, what does the stone represent? Well, let's read it. Verse 38 tells us, you, Nebuchadnezzar, are this head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon, is the head of gold. Next are two kingdoms, which conservative Bible scholars identify as Medo-Persia and Greece, and these indeed were the two next great empires. The fourth empire, like iron, is identified with the Roman Empire. Okay, look at verse 44. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now this is that kingdom of peace that we've been reading about in Isaiah 2 and Isaiah 11, Micah 4, and so on. Now I'm not going to do a detailed exegesis of this passage. You'll have to take our Daniel course. But the fact of the matter is, this kingdom that's represented by the stone, verse 45, is the messianic kingdom. It's the kingdom of Christ. Now, we notice that the kingdoms that go before it, that is the image, are all literal kingdoms. So this last kingdom, represented by the stone, in other words, it's not a man-made kingdom, it comes from the outside and imposes itself on the worldly kingdoms, that's going to be a literal earthly kingdom too. Otherwise, it's difficult to fully understand the imagery here, and certainly would be very difficult for Daniel and his hearers to understand it, given all of the prophetic teachings that they knew by heart and the literal kingdom that they were expecting. Now, this kingdom is, of course, the kingdom of Christ under the new covenant. Not that Daniel mentions it, but we've learned enough, I think, to identify it quite easily. Now, these four kingdoms crop up again in the very important vision in Daniel chapter 7. So turn there. This was given in the first year of Belshazzar, so after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. This is a long time afterwards, 40-odd years, many years after the vision of Daniel 2. And Daniel sees four great beasts coming up from the sea. Now, the sea could well be here symbolic of mankind, as it seems to be in Matthew 13:47, Revelation 13:1, and see also on this Isaiah 17, verses 12 and 13. Now, these four great beasts have been identified as Babylon, verse 4, Medo-Persia, verse 5, Greece, verse 6, and Rome, verse 7. So you have the same four kingdoms as we found in Daniel 2. There's also note taken that this fourth beast had 10 horns, and there's something important about the horns themselves which needs to be commented on, which is spoken about in verse 8. Now, of course, the image in chapter 2 would have had 10 toes, which probably correspond to the 10 horns in 7:7. Now, verse 8 says, I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, so that's an 11th horn, a little one coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked up out of the roots. And there, in this horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. We'll go back to this when we deal with Antichrist in the next course. But if you want to get a jump start, you can read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Okay, verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. And the description of his throne is rather like in Isaiah 6. But notice that little word in verse 9, till. I watched till thrones were put in place. That reminds us of chapter 2 and verse 35, when the stone comes and smites the other kingdoms. Verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain, that's the beast that the horn is on, and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. This is very mysterious, and I don't want to hazard a guess as to what's going on. Some prophetic scholars do. but I've never been convinced by what they've said, and anyway, it doesn't really impact what we have to say in this course. Verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. If that rings a bell, the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, that is because Jesus himself quoted that passage back to the Jewish leadership at his trial, Matthew 26, verse 64. Now, when the high priest heard that, see the next verse, he accused Jesus of blasphemy because he knew that Jesus was claiming to be this Son of Man, this one who came from the Ancient of Days, Daniel 7, verse 13. The one who was to be given what? Verse 14, dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion, just as the stone in Daniel 2, is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So this again is the kingdom of the Messiah. It is again an earthly kingdom. Notice the peoples in verse 14 still have different ethnic identities and different languages. Notice that. This is an earthly kingdom that's being spoken of, even though it extends into eternity. Now the chapter goes on to describe the terrible time inflicted upon Israel, especially under this little horn, this future religious leader. But he is going to be destroyed. Verse 26. Then, verse 27, the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. That's Messiah, Christ. So again, what we see predicted here is a time of great suffering for Daniel's people, Israel, in the future. And this suffering will be in the latter days, and it will be ended by the coming of the Son of Man in the clouds of heaven. In other words, by the second coming of Christ to set up his kingdom. All right, turn to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel 9, of course, is the famous confession of Daniel and the prayer for himself and for his people. The confession involves him telling God, first of all in verse 4, that God is a covenant-keeping God, but that the people of Israel are a covenant-breaking people. That's what Moses said and Joshua said, and the prophets all said that too. So Daniel's just agreeing with that. See also Nehemiah chapter 9 and his confession, which agrees with this. Now notice in verse 16 and 17, in Daniel's prayer, that he's praying for, quote, your city, Jerusalem, your people, verse 16, and your sanctuary, which is desolate, verse 17. That is the temple. So let's see if God responds in the second half of Daniel 9 to Daniel's prayer. Verse 20. Now while I was speaking, praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, not the church, Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, that's Mount Zion. Yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, angels appear as men in the Bible, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. Therefore consider the matter and understand the vision. Now, in passing here, notice that Daniel is so imbued with Jewish sacrificial system that he speaks about the time of the evening offering in verse 29, even though, of course, that had stopped many years before when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 24, this is what Gabriel tells Daniel. 70 weeks are determined for your people. Who are Daniel's people? The ones he's been praying for. My people Israel, verse 20. Do you see that? So he's talking about Israel and your holy city. That's Jerusalem. And then to do a number of things. To finish the transgression. To make an end of sins. To make reconciliation for iniquity. To bring in everlasting righteousness. To seal up vision and prophecy. To anoint the most holy. Alright, let's have a look at verse 24 in a little more detail. First, to finish the transgression. What's that got to do with? Well, it's got to do with the transgression of the Jews that Daniel's been praying about. To make an end of sins. Well, that's got to do with the end of sinning, particularly the sins that got Israel in the mess that they were in Daniel's time in the first place. To make reconciliation for iniquity. That has to do, of course, with Christ's substitutionary work and the Jews' belief in it. To bring in everlasting righteousness. Well, of course, that echoes the New Covenant verse in Jeremiah 31, 33 and 34. That has to do with Christ's second coming and the kingdom of righteousness that he sets up. To seal up vision and prophecy. Well, there'll be no need for vision and prophecy when Jesus returns. This, by the way, explains passages like Zechariah 13, verses 2 through 5, which speak about somebody putting on the rough garb of a prophet and pretending to be a prophet in the kingdom age, that his parents will run him through as being a false prophet. There'll be no need for prophecy when Jesus is on the throne in Jerusalem. And then the most controversial one, to anoint the most holy. Well, people that tend to spiritualize the Old Testament prophecies say that that's got to do with anointing of Christ. Well, the anointing of Christ happened at his first coming under John the Baptist, didn't it? Matthew 3. But the term the most holy here is not a term that is applied in the Old Testament to Messiah. It is usually applied to the temple itself, particularly the Holy of Holies. Now, in our study of Daniel, in our course on Daniel, we make a strong case that all of these six predictions have to do with the second coming of Christ for their fulfillment. Now, since Christ is not going to be anointed at his second coming, he's already Christ, it makes sense that it is the dedication of the new sanctuary that is being spoken about. And so again, what we find is that we have a prediction of another temple for the Jews in the future, when they have been reconciled to God under the terms of the new covenant. So the priestly covenant and the new covenant are seen together in this passage. Then you have the mysterious prediction of the 70 weeks, and we'll include a lecture about that. It's been interpreted in all kinds of different ways, but there is a straightforward interpretation that makes the most sense of it, and that leaves the 70th week, the last week, still in abeyance. But notice in verse 24, the 70 weeks are determined on Israel and Jerusalem, not on the church. The church doesn't have any part in this. Okay, moving on to chapter 10, another angel contacts Daniel in verse 10, and as part of the message he says to Daniel in verse 14, "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people," that's the Jews, "in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come." Then you have rehearsed this long vision in chapter 11 of Israel's history, especially under Greek rule and Roman rule. But then in verse 36, things change a bit. In verse 36, then it seems that the person who is being described, the willful king, as he's sometimes known, is speaking of the future Antichrist. I believe it is, some believe it's not. The main reason is because the angel had told Daniel that this has to do with the latter days, and even though a lot of chapter 11 rehearses Israel's history after the time of Daniel, yet the main emphasis is on this last act from verse 36 through to verse 45. In fact, it goes into chapter 12. At that time, Michael, that's the archangel, shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, Israel. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. That reminds us of Jeremiah chapter 30, verses 6 and 7. You might also want to check out Malachi 3, verses 1 through 3, Matthew 24, 21, and even Ezekiel 20, verses 34 through 38 on this. Verse 2 of Daniel 12, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life. Well, that, of course, has to happen at the last days. That's a resurrection, a literal resurrection there. Some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, for that to happen, Jesus has to come back. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Then Daniel is told to seal the book until the time of the end. Now this phrase, time of the end, is repeated in verse 9 and also in verse 13, the last verse of the book. It speaks of the end of the days. I believe has to do with the latter days, the end times. Now in verse 7, in answer to the question of verse 6, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? An answer comes back, which is sworn by an oath, notice, an oath to God, that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Now, the holy people is probably a reference to Israel. They're considered holy by God because they're his, by covenant, not because they are holy in themselves, of course. And this shattering is that time of Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30, and that which was spoken of in 12:1, and also in Daniel 7, verses 24 and following. But in Daniel 7:25, we see this time period, time and times and half a time. That has to do with the persecution of the saints of the Most High by this little horn speaking pompous words against God. Now, we're not told how long time, times, and half a time is, but this is a phrase that's used also in Revelation. So when we get to the book of Revelation, we will examine this again. But from Daniel's prophecy, we get the definite impression that before the coming of the everlasting kingdom, the messianic kingdom, Daniel's people, Israel, are going to undergo a terrible time of persecution and difficulty, the time of Jacob's trouble. Only then, after passing through that time, a time that we designate by the word the tribulation, will Israel be in a position to be saved and enter into the blessings of the new covenant. That is when they are whittled down to a believing remnant. And it is the remnant that we will look at in the next lecture.